Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
So, good evening. Thank you all for coming, particularly in this extreme heat stress. It's very good of you to be here. Or maybe some of you knew in advance that this is an air-conditioned room. But you're here not for the air conditioning, you're here to attend the global launch of Smarter Than the Storm. Now, I'm not going to summarise Smarter Than the Storm because the authors are here and they're going to do exactly that. But I do want to say that the combination of climate and AI that it focuses on is clearly critical, and I've never seen them put together in such a creative way as the authors of the book have done. And they are, of course, Amitabh Kant and Siddharth Sinha, who are here on my right. They will speak for about 45 minutes between them, and then we'll have a commentary of a total about 15 minutes or so by Emma Howard-Boyd and Ruth Katumuri. So let me very briefly introduce the speakers. Amitabh Kant is a very old friend. For me, that's the most important. But he is also a very distinguished national and international public servant. IAS officer, Indian Administrative Service. He was Secretary of Tourism and Secretary of Industry, the highest positions in those ministries. He's had a lot of creative leadership in Make in India, Incredible India, National Green Hydrogen Mission, and so on. Of special significance was his time served as the Chief Executive Officer of Niti Aayog, which is the successor to the Planning Commission in India, and the most creative and shaping of the CEOs, I think, is unambiguously Amitabh in what he made Niti to be. And of course, something where I was very close to him and saw up close in that way how he led so much of the extraordinarily successful G20 presidency of India in 2023. And maybe enjoying the questions and so on, some of that experience might be coming through. He's now advisor or on the board of a number of private sector companies. Siddharth Sinha, well, first and foremost, he is a graduate of the London School of Economics, so one must always begin there. He did an MBA here, MPA here. He worked at Niti Aayog. He worked very much on the G20 in 2023 that I've just described. He's worked at Google, and where he helped accelerate AI-enabled climate interventions and co-conceptualized a global air quality management solution. So again, I think some of that will come out in the discussion. So he's not just talking about putting AI and climate together, he's been doing that directly. Emma, another long-standing friend, if it's very nice to have you here at the LSE, because it's always good to hear you speak, but now you're one of us, you're a professor of practice here at LSE, and you're leading the chair of the Independent National Heat Risk Commission. And that means that Emma is from the media, the UK media, absolutely top demand, because chair of the National Heat Risk Commission sounds like and is the absolutely most important person that you need to talk to on days like this. She had a very distinguished leadership from the Environment Agency. 6 years, I think, Emma. Finally, Ruth Katumuri, of course, starting first, PhD from the London School of Economics. We worked very closely together over the years in the India Observatory and the Asia Research Centre. In the recent past, she is the Senior Director for Economic Development, Trade and Investment, or Senior Director of that Directorate at the Commonwealth of Nations. And she, in that position, has to lead on technical and strategic leadership, economic, on economic development, debt management, and so on. And that is the panel. It's extraordinarily distinguished. But first things first, we'd like to hear about this tremendous new book, which you can buy and you will be available for signing after this lecture. So it's Smarter Than the Storm. And Siddharth, could I ask you to lead off on its presentation, and then I'm sure Amitabh will pick up.
Good evening, everyone. I think at the outset, the title of the book is Smarter Than the Storm. I don't know about a storm, but there is a terrible heat wave in the United Kingdom. And by wearing jackets, I think definitely we've not been smarter than this particular storm that's hit the UK today. So drenched in sweat, but it's such an honor that we have Lord Stern, who is chairing this panel here today. Mr. Kant, of course, who's done stellar work. You know, his journey is very well known. Emma, you know, her work on, you know, heat and the risks associated with that. Ruth, equally wonderful it's been, you know, to see so many of the people I know. Dr. Banerjee, who's been my professor here. You know, Maitre, one of my best friends, who's at the FCDO. And a very, very warm welcome to Mr. Jayant Sinha, who's been a former minister in the Government of India, now with Eversource Capital, and a very, very big believer in, you know, in how we can leverage finance to deal with the climate crisis that the world is facing today. Of course, Mr. Sinha is now also a professor in practice at the London School of Economics' Global School of Sustainability. Now, I will not take too much of time to talk about the book. I think, as Mr. Kant would always say, that I should not give away too much about the book. That is best left for all of you to read about it. But I will say a few things about the book. Yeah. First of all, I think the most important thing about this book is that it is written through a human lens. You know, when you pick up the book, you will not start to read complex jargon and, you know, complicated words about AI and climate. You're not going to read through any of that. This entire book is actually nonfiction because it is about the interplay of AI and climate, yet it is actually narrated through fictional characters. And while those characters might be fictional, they actually represent lived realities, what some of us may have faced, what many others outside may have faced. So the four characters that you will find throughout this book are Asha, who's actually a girl who represents the Global South, who comes from a country from the Global South, you know, who lives in a country that is, you know, affected by conflict that has actually been triggered by the climate crisis. You've got another young girl whose name is Sophie, who comes from the Global North, and her house was burned down because of a wildfire, because of the extreme heat that we are facing, much to the extent of what we are dealing with now. And, you know, in the green room, Emma mentioned how 2022, I believe, was one of the worst heat waves in the United Kingdom, where, you know, hospitals were shut down, but also there were a lot of fires in houses, etc. And I also remember that year, because when you're talking about AI, that was also the year that Oracle and Google data centers got knocked offline because of the extreme heat that the city of London witnessed. And of course, in addition to these two characters, which sort of represent the problems that they're facing with the world as it is today, especially given the context of climate, the book also has two really interesting characters, a mayor of a town who actually teams up with a young graduate from a college or a university, much like some of you, and they actually team up to implement the roadmap. So the book is essentially about three parts. The first part actually talks about why climate change actually creates very, very vicious cycles. And the problem with climate is that it is called a threat multiplier. It is called a threat multiplier because it takes existing situations and it amplifies them, it worsens them. I mean, I don't want to get into examples, but just think about a scenario where conflict is caused as a result of drought or floods which are triggered by climate change. Those drought or those floods lead to political instability in those countries. They increase the chances of conflict. That conflict or the increase of it actually could cause critical resources to not even be, let's say, mined or extracted properly. And that could even affect the very data centers that are being built today, because fiber optic cables need erbium. Your data center equipment needs rare earth elements and critical minerals. So the idea is that climate is a threat multiplier. It takes existing vicious cycles and it amplifies them further, creating a vicious cycle that is difficult to get out of. This is the first part of the book, but it also talks about the fact that there is a wonderful opportunity that the emerging economies have, which has, of course, been inspired by Mr. Kant's thinking and actual action on this front, that while emerging economies have been at the receiving end in terms of what the climate change is doing, so we are highest in terms of the vulnerability to climate change, we have been the lowest per capita emitters. So we've been the lowest per capita emitters, yet we are at the highest risk of the impacts of climate change. But what we also have is the greatest opportunity. And that greatest opportunity is the ability to industrialize without the need to carbonize, because we are still developing. Innovation in our country is still catching up, but institutions are still evolving. So you've got a time-sensitive opportunity to ensure that they co-evolve together. Now, amidst the challenges that are posed by climate, what also comes through is a very interesting opportunity or a very interesting disruption, which is artificial intelligence. And I know this has become a household name. You know, you put AI before your startup and you're for sure to get a good amount of funding for your startup, because AI is a word that's thrown around quite a bit. But what's also interesting about AI is the fact that AI can be used to combat climate change across all three categories, across adaptation, across mitigation, across protection. So the second part of the book takes some of the most interesting and unique case studies from across the world, which show how today AI is being used to detect the impact of stress, heat stress on crops, how it is used to predict heat waves, how it is used to predict wildfires, how it is used to predict floods, how it can be used to optimize grids, and so on and so forth. But then we also accept that the story with AI is not as good as it sounds. It, of course, has a very big impact in terms of the water and the energy that it consumes. But is that the only threat? The answer is no. The biggest threat, perhaps, of course, is the energy and consumption, yes. But that aside, the very fact that over 80% of the world's AI compute is actually in the developed part of the world, and more so in just one country, whereas the data for a lot of these AI models gets shipped out from the emerging economies, brings a question of sovereignty. And equally, the third problem with AI is the fact that when you're building AI-based solutions, not just for climate, but for any other thematic area, be it health, be it nutrition, you want to ensure that the data that you're training your models on is actually accurate and that it is available and that it is usable. And you don't end up training it on a very small subset of data and then you end up applying it to the rest of the world, because that's going to throw some very, very problematic outputs. I mean, I can't even imagine what will end up happening if you falsely fail to predict a cloudburst in the Himalayas, let's say, and you fail to evacuate a village. But in the process of finding these three challenges, we realized that these three are not just challenges. They're actually opportunities. They're opportunities because in the process of solving for these three challenges, you can create a roadmap that does not only apply to climate and energy, but it applies to every other sector. And what we talk about essentially are climate and community positive data centers as a solution to the energy and power consumption. And I won't, you know, jump into it too much because, you know, I don't want to give away the entire book, but that's why you should read the book. We talk about the digital public infrastructure that will solve for the problem of the lack or the limited amount of data that you have. And equally, we talk about how what the future for sovereign AI looks like. The whole idea of this book is, in very simple terms, how do we convert challenges into opportunities? How do we go from incremental leaps to bold steps? How do we go from creating vicious cycles to creating virtuous cycles? And how do we just get our hands dirty in everything that we are doing? I would just like to conclude. It's very off this book, but it just reminds me of something that my grandfather says. My grandfather is an Indian poet. He writes in Urdu. A part of his poem is something that has always stayed with me. It's in Hindi, but I'll use the English version, or I can say it in Hindi as well. It says, "Pul paar karne se pul paar hota hai, nadi paar nahi hoti, nadi paar nahi hoti, pani mein dhase bina, aur pani mein dhase bina, na pul ka arth samajh mein aata hai, na nadi ka arth samajh mein aata hai." This translates to when you cross a river, when you cross a bridge, you cross the bridge. You do not cross the river. You do not cross the river until and unless you've waded into the muddy waters. And until and unless you've waded into the muddy waters, you do not even understand what the significance of the bridge was to begin with. So the idea of this book is to simplify AI in climate to the extent that you dirty yourselves in these muddy waters and you understand what a blueprint for the future can look like. And also a very warm welcome to Ambassador Paul Simons, who's formerly been with the International Energy Agency. Lovely to see you here, Ambassador. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Please. Let me first thank all of you for having braved the London heat wave to join us at this event here. And let me thank Nick from the School of Sustainability for having organized this. He's been an old friend of mine, and I greatly appreciate it. Emma, Ruth, my co-author Siddharth, Mr. Jayant Sinha, Paul, many distinguished people here. And many of you have joined us here today. We're truly delighted to be at the LSE today. Basically, there are four things happening in the world. And first of which is that that the relative period of stability post-World War II, when the institutions, multilateral institutions of United Nations, Security Council, later the World Trade Organization, were established, that period of stability has come to an end. You have a conflict in the heart of Europe, and all of us must know this, that the First World War was fought in Europe, the Second World War was fought in Europe, and you have a conflict in the heart of Europe for over 4.5 years now. And it's not showing no signs of abating. You had a major crisis in the Middle East. More lives were lost in a much shorter conflict in the Middle East, in Gaza, than they've been lost in the Russia-Ukraine war. And on top of that, you have a huge conflict in West Asia, which has sent the global economies spiraling because it has led to a huge choking of oil supplies, and the prices have gone up substantially and impacted the economies of Global South and the emerging market. So the period of stability has been replaced by a period of conflicts across the world. The second is that in the last four decades, vast segments of the population were lifted above the poverty line because of free trade, because of global supply chains and global value chains were working. And that enabled companies to import and produce at low costs and produce efficiently and penetrate global markets. And therefore, production moved to some of the emerging markets, and that led to vast segments of population across China and India getting lifted above the poverty line. Those value chains have been totally disrupted, and global value chains and supply chains have been substituted with protectionism and muscular industrial policies across the world. And it's happened with USA, it's happened across the world, and it's had a spiraling impact. The third is that the climate situation is actually worsening, much worsening. The world, I've been coming to London for 4.5 decades, year after year, and I've never seen London so hot. And actually, if you're wearing a jacket, it's very, very unbearable. And 4,000 extreme heat events in the last few years have had an impact on 1.6 billion people. It's led to a loss of close to over $2.5 trillion worth of global economy. And actually, the impact of all this is being felt by emerging markets in the global south. One flood in Pakistan actually led to a 9% wiping out of its economy. Nepal, it led to almost 11% of its economy getting wiped out. In smaller island states like Vanuatu, it has an impact of almost one adverse impact. One event has an impact of knocking out almost 64% of its GDP. So this is as a consequence not merely of climate risk, poor infrastructure, lack of data, lack of ability to foresee it and take corrective measures. So several factors: climate risk, industrial infrastructure, new urbanization, lack of good information flow, and our ability to analyze and examine all this is playing a very key factor in all this. So the climate situation is actually worsening across the world, and that's a critical issue which we need to discuss and debate. There's lack of political will, there's lack of administrative action, and actually across the world, led by United States, we've seen unpredictability and inconsistency of policies and lack of political commitment on climate. We saw this after we'd achieved consensus at COP21 in Paris. United States backed out, change of government. Subsequently, they brought in measures like the Inflation Reduction Act, etc., during the Biden administration, pushing for it, and you've seen complete backtracking in favor of fossil fuel subsequently during the President Trumpian regime. So you've seen unpredictability, inconsistency of climate policies. But in the midst of all this conflict, breakdown of supply chains, worsening of climate scenario, there's one force which is the biggest force which we are seeing today. The biggest force, and we are fortunate to be sitting in the Long Trong Theater at a point of time and to be living at this point of time, when data, machine learning, artificial intelligence has the potential to have the biggest impact on the lives of human beings in terms of enhanced productivity, in terms of improving learning outcomes, health outcomes, making an impact on climate, sustainability, and on lifting vast segments of population above the poverty line. We've never seen a force, a technological force like this, and the impact of its diffusion has been so rapid. Industrial Revolution took century. What we are seeing in a matter of 2 years, 3 years, is a vast amount of diffusion of technology that has taken place. If you read the Stanford AI Index, there's been a 53% diffusion, and there's been a fall in AI models of almost about 280%. It's never seen before. Sharp decline in prices, but a huge rise in diffusion, technological diffusion across the world. So AI will be the most transformational force in terms of making an impact on lives of citizens and on making a difference to sustainability and climate in the coming years. Now, it's important to point out that today, AI consumes, it emits more CO2 emission than the entire city of AI models are emitting more CO2 emission than the entire city of New York. We should know this. It consumes more water than the entire supply of bottled water by the water industry in the world today. It's consuming more water than that. And it actually, consuming more energy than a country like Japan consumes. So it consumes more energy than Japan, and in another 3 years, it'll be consuming more energy than what India consumes. So it's a guzzler of energy, it's a guzzler of water, and it's a guzzler of, it's a great emitter of CO2 emission. Now, these are realities we are confronted with. And the challenge is that the other part of the challenge is that it's important to dwell on this a little bit, that it's a global industry. What you're seeing is huge computing power coming in from one company, NVIDIA, massive computing power. You're seeing chips being supplied by TSMC of Taiwan. You're seeing it being supplied by Samsung and SK Hynix from Korea. And you're seeing the huge value acceleration of NVIDIA. You're seeing huge value acceleration of SK Hynix. You're seeing huge value and acceleration of Samsung. But you're seeing that these chips require lithography machines, and therefore the lithography machines are coming from one company in Netherlands. And they also require one company, MP, from Netherlands, and they require glasses which come in from Germany, and they require helium gas which comes in from Qatar. So it's a globally interdependent world as far as computing power is concerned, as far as AI is concerned. You have several players. You have computing power, you have chips, you have lithography machines, you have gas, you have glasses, all this. It's a globally interdependent world. But AI is driven, the fuel for driving AI is data. Data is the key. And today, if you look at it, almost 20% of the global data comes from India. OpenAI consumes 33% more data from India than it consumes from the United States of America. So the fuel for this is going to come from many of the emerging markets of the world. That's important to understand. The second point is that AI requires great talent. And if you look at the talent comes from, if you look at the Stanford AI Index, for the first time they say, and it's 9 years of AI index being produced, for the first time they're saying that talent is moving from rest of the world to India. And this talent is moving to India largely because of the global capability centers that have been set up, 2,717 global capability centers, and also because of a number of startups working in this field of AI. And therefore, the third point they make is that a huge amount of technology diffusion has taken place in a country like India. Now, important thing is that we should be very clear that huge computing power is being used. So if you look at OpenAI's new deal with NVIDIA, it envisages 5 gigawatt of supply of computing power means about 5,000 models of latest models of Blackwell. I mean, that's excessive amount of computing power being used. Whereas DeepSeek demonstrated that you can actually achieve the same results with better reasoning with far sophisticated software and less computing power. Now, as AI is going to get commoditized. It's important for all of us to understand. It'll work only when it gets commoditized. There's a business model to it. And that business model, otherwise it'll be a bubble which will burst. The commoditization will happen with data coming in from most emerging markets. And if you keep supplying data, somebody else produces the intelligence and then sells it back to you, that would mean reverse colonization. It's important for all of us to understand. So, important thing for all of us is that firstly, whatever we do it in a manner where we ensure sustainability, excessive amount of computing power. Secondly, most emerging markets, because of the data, will be putting up data centers. What you're seeing in India is a massive boom of data centers. Close to about $70 billion has already been invested. Another $90 billion by hyperscalers like Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and Indian Tata's, L&T, many others, has already been announced. So about $160 billion worth of money resources coming in for data centers. Now, if data centers are going to be put up using fossil fuel, if they're going to consume water in areas where water is not available, it'll be a disaster for the world. It'll be an absolute disaster for the world, and you'll have... And this point I'm making because most emerging markets, the process of urbanization and industrialization has just begun. And the emerging markets in Global South will do more industrialization and urbanization than what they've done in the last 50 years. The process of urbanization, the Western world has moved into the post-industrial society, and therefore it's the more and more of guzzling of energy that will happen in the Global South with data centers being put up there will actually destroy them. So it's important that they are done in a very sustainable manner, that you use this opportunity to push for renewables, you use this opportunity to put up, to establish cooling centers, to push much of this through recycling of water, etc., is what we highlight in this book. And we say that it's an opportunity. It's not a challenge, it's an opportunity. You can't bypass the era of AI. AI will be a transformational force. It will transform the lives. And in emerging markets, it's an opportunity to technologically leapfrog. In the past, when the industrial revolution happened, when the electric revolution happened, when the computer revolution happened, it bypassed the Global South and the emerging markets. It's important that the emerging markets and Global South use this as an opportunity to technologically leapfrog and use this as an opportunity to leapfrog. But it's also important that they use this opportunity to demonstrate that it's possible to do AI and data centers with green growth, green technology. It's possible to recycle water, possible to use the heat generated, and possible to use much of this to actually have a positive impact on industrial growth. So I don't want to take too much time in trying to sell you. I don't want to give the plot away because there are human stories in this book. I'd prefer that you buy the book and read it and benefit from it because it's a transformational force. It'll have a huge impact on society, and we are optimists, we are believers in positivity, and we believe that this is a massive opportunity to transform the Global South and emerging markets. We also believe that it's possible, it's necessary for Global South to actually use this opportunity to build AI, which is transformational. AI will not be fit for purpose if it is not multilingual in a country like India, which has 22 languages and which has thousands of dialects. It'll not be fit for purpose if it is not low bandwidth. And much like what we have demonstrated through digital public infrastructure, where we build the digital layer, it was a public layer. It was a public interest layer. But Nick, on top of that, we allowed private sector to innovate and compete. And therefore, India is the only country in the world which has 1.4 billion digital identities, but it does fast payment, credit, stock market transactions, insurance, all within 30 seconds to 1 minute on the mobile, on the go, anywhere in the world. And that is a unique contribution of India in terms of the digital public infrastructure. And I think what we need to create is a climate public infrastructure which will enable data to be opened out, which will enable for us to really use the power of data, the power of machine learning, the power of artificial intelligence to transform the lives of citizens across the world instead of creating inequalities across the world. So we are believers in positivity, we are believers in optimism, and we are believers that AI will have a positive, long-term positive impact if the Global South and the emerging market uses as a force to technologically leapfrog, because eventually the test of AI is, will it be able to transform human lives? Will it be able to improve learning outcomes? Will it be able to improve health outcomes? Will it be able to improve nutritional standards? Will it be able to do away with large-scale stunting and wasting? And will it be a force of good for sustainability in the world? And conclude with these few words. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is this one working? Yeah. So let me continue from here, and we sort of go into discussion mode with the five of us here. But thank you so much, Siddharth and Amitabh. It's absolutely visionary, very exciting, hard to do, but must do. Yeah. And Emma, could you offer us some thoughts and comments?
Delighted to be here. I think, Nick, you and I have a habit in meeting in heat waves. The last time, I think we may have seen each other in between, but we met recently at the Hay Festival of Books, where Nick was talking about his book. We're here to talk about your book tonight. But I think what is so wonderful is the way you weave real life characters throughout your book. I think this is what we need to do more of, to take, it's so important to have those descriptions of the lived experience. I see it in the select committees that I give evidence to, where they're looking at environmental issues, fire risk issues, climate flooding issues, that when you have the people who have suffered or are experiencing those impacts give evidence, the members of parliament respond in a very, very different way. So one of the reasons I was at Hay Festival is because it also now has a climate fiction prize to celebrate books that are giving a different, telling the story of climate, but also the story of solutions. And given that a lot of my work over the last decade or so has been looking at how we take impacts and turn them into solutions, recognizing the scale of the challenge, the way that you also describe how this kind of technology can help in terms of warning and informing and giving cities, countries, communities more time as storms are literally approaching. This is something that here we are in London. Boy, can we learn from other parts of the world in terms of getting better prepared. And I think this is something that not only from the work that I've been doing in London for the Mayor of London, I led something called the London Climate Resilience Review, which we published in 2024. Very excited that later this week the Mayor will be launching a heat plan. But I also chair an organization, co-chair an organization, it used to be called Climate Resilience for All. It is called HERA, standing for Heat Resilience Action, but it works with communities around the world in partnership with organizations around the world to deliver solutions. And I can see how some of the technologies that you are highlighting coming into reality in the way that we are beginning to protect citizens impacted by heat in very, very different ways. So connecting early warning systems to insurance products. And so again, what I love is this focus on a part of the world showing us how to do things so differently that a part of the world here in London can learn so much from, so that we are better protecting citizens everywhere. That positivity, I suppose I've spent today, I'm feeling, just recognised as I was sitting here listening to you that this is probably the first time this day I've sat and been able to listen as opposed to be ready to speak to. I've done a lot of media interviews today, and just having that sense of what is possible and what we can do differently. Nick always talks about how climate has to be the growth opportunity of the rest of this century, and I think you, through your book, have shown how that becomes possible and how the solutions, as illustrated through real-life characters, can make it feel so much more tantalising and optimistic and full of hope, whilst embedding the reality that we have to bring these new technologies to the fore in a very sustainable way. So thank you. Thank you for inviting me here to give a few comments, and I'm looking forward to questions from the audience.
Thank you, Emma. Thank you. Over to you, Ruth.
Thanks, Nick. Let me say welcome to Amitabh and Siddharth for coming to the LSE and speaking about this book. Now, Amitabh has been a thought leader in all that he has done, from Incredible India Tag to this AI and Climate Nexus. For me, I find this AI and Climate Nexus absolutely interesting. I was a 10-year-old in India when I had this defining moment that I wanted to save the planet. And I was 10 several decades ago. And I'm part of the group in India which laid the foundation for technology, again, several decades ago. This was pre-internet. It was pre-outsourcing, that generation. So for me, bringing these two together is unique. And it's also very topical and very new, because not many books are there talking about AI and Climate Nexus right now. So as usual, Amitabh has shown his leadership of not only being innovative and thought leadership, but he's also showed effective implementation. But on a side light note, I would like to say that I think Amitabh has benefited from being of South Indian cadre. And Nick may disagree with this, but he actually spent, I think, memorable time in Bangalore as well. And now Amitabh has found a collaborator, Siddharth, who are able to do this work together. And I would suggest Siddharth can benefit from spending some time in South India as well. Coming back to the focus of the book, one of the chapters, I mean, it's in three parts, climate and then AI and climate. And of course, the last part is about solutions. We've heard them speak about it. I just want to refer to the title they have. One of the sections is on a warming world, and we are experiencing this here, and increasingly so. Yesterday, the UN Secretary General, I quote him, London is cooking. Yeah, so that's where we are, and we've all seen enough of London to know that it never was the case before. Then I think I like the two sections on rethinking climate equity, which he has spoken a little bit about, but highlighting, of course, the challenges and opportunities. Of course, there are many challenges, but what are the opportunities? So if you seek AI, I'll just read what I found. Moving towards green AI, the overall climate impact of AI will depend on regulation, corporate accountability, and technological innovation. Organizations are increasingly focusing on green AI to mitigate the economic environmental impacts of technology itself. And what are the key areas they have referred to? Smart cooling, sustainable software, policy, and offsetting. Now, this is the way forward. This is where we need thinkers, and there is more work increasingly being done. There are more publications coming up, which means there is still more work to be done. And Amitabh spoke about technology to leapfrog. Now, I want to I was at an interesting, participating in an interesting UN event earlier today, where this is, I think, Amitabh talked about supply chains for technology itself, including AI. And that, what the UN is working on, it is on sustainable procurement implementation framework, which they're planning to launch at UNGA in September. Now, that's all innovative and important work leading to how do we manage the world we are in. But while I was reading at this book, Amitabh, I also want to kind of raise a question. Because of the way I think of it, and in this room, and for a country with about 500 million young people, one of the thoughts that came is when we're thinking about the AI and climate nexus, how do we then address, when we talk about AI in general, the first thought that comes to people is loss of employment. So if we have to think about AI and climate change, how can the challenges of current employment outlook be developed into opportunity within the AI climate nexus? And let me give some references. If we look at UK data, over 1 million 16 to 24 years olds are not in education, employment, or training. So needs over 1 million. Now this is 30.5% of this demography in UK. Now let me look at India, which is the largest labor market, featuring a net employment outlook of 48%. Despite strong hiring velocity, it remains a complex paradox of high graduate unemployment, heavy reliance on informal and agricultural labor, and an ongoing productivity shift driven by generative AI. What are the key market dynamics in India? The jobless growth paradox, which is an important example of how India is leading in these. Massive demographic dividend, transition from education, employment is strained. Graduate unemployment is 35 to 40% due to mismatch between job seekers' aspirations and available entry-level salaried roles. Secondly, the sector. Over 45% is dependent on agriculture. Our sectors such as 10 to 15 million there is a flattening of the IT BPO sector. Then there's a positive on women's participation is on the rise, though disproportionately engaging in informal or low productivity employment. I just want us to think about these as well among the solutions. India, yes, has been the solution, is being a leader and a solution as among the emerging markets, and it will continue to lead in solutions as Amitabh stated. So even in this space, I think, in this whole nexus between AI and climate nexus, within the aspect of how do we meet the challenges of our times, of finding employment and addressing these issues, we'd love to hear your thoughts on that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ruth. Now, would you like, I had one or two questions, but would you like to respond first to Emma and Ruth, and then we throw it open?
I think we can throw it open, and we'll weave in the questions raised by them along.
Okay, and let's throw it open now, and I'll ask some questions along the way. If there's time, I'm sure other people...
Your question should be the final concluding question paper.
Okay. So we have, given that we'll spend 5 or 10 minutes concluding at the end, we've got about half an hour for questions. So could you speak very closely to the mic and tell us who you are and then ask a brief question? Now, we've got some splendid people in red here who are carrying the microphones. This gentleman at the front, please. We'll take three at a time,
Thank you very much indeed. The name's Ewan Grant, UK Defence Forum. In my TV and radio work, I've made frequent reference to the book Ghost Fleet, which is also a co-written book, and uses the same technique that you have, facts through the words of fictional characters. It is well known in its field, so I look forward to your book. My question is, where do you see the bottlenecks, particularly regarding physical materials in achieving the aims? What are the material bottlenecks that are going to delay getting the power consumption down?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is a lady just here? You've got the mic already. Very good.
Thanks. Hey,
could I remind you just keep close to the mic because the acoustics here are not brilliant, and it's a bit easier if you keep the mic close.
Okay. Super, thank you. My name's Sarah Kemet. I work for the UN Environment Programme Finance Initiative, but I'm asking the question in my personal capacity. One thing that wasn't mentioned, and I think maybe it could be a fifth trend. Your four trends were incredibly interesting. Fifth trend is widening inequality in society, and one thing that the technological innovations is resulting in is these incredibly wealthy billionaires and now even trillionaires, and they are having the most enormous destabilizing impact on democracy, the media, their control communication channels, social media, etc. So, you know, they have immense power, power more than countries in a way. How do we democratize this technology, and how do we make sure that it is used for a public good, not just for profit for a very few people? Thank you.
Thank you. Gentleman at the front here, blue, and then we'll go.
Thank you, sir,
get
for
responses
giving
to this, and we go around to another three. Yeah.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I am Ashish, a chartered accountant from India, a big fan of Amitabh, sir. He has been the biggest champion of the Global South. And the reason I am pursuing AI, because I heard his session in Impact India Summit, which India hosted some months back. So, yeah. Thank you, sir. My question is, sir, I've asked this in a lot of forums. There's a trade war going on between the two biggest economies of the world, or we say the two big powers. Now, why that trade war between those two nations should be a hindrance to developing nations, or what we call as a global south? Why should we suffer the collateral damage, and how should we steer amongst these troubled times and still be on our growth path? Thank you, sir.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you. Would you like to take those three, yeah, please?
So, I'll first of all, to the point about to the issue which Ruth raised about jobs, job losses. You know, I believe that every time you've had onset of new technology and technological disruption, the same thing was said when industrial revolution happened in UK, that jobs will be lost. And the same thing, exactly the same thing was said when the great electricity came in, that vast number of jobs will be lost. This is new technology coming in. This will be disruption, and job losses will be enormous. And exactly the same thing. And I was working in Kerala when computerization happened, and Kerala was only stated. Kerala was being then ruled by the Communist Party of India, and they did not allow Kerala to computerize for 2 decades, saying that this will lead to loss of jobs. Then they computerized their own party office, the CPI party office, CPM party office. And then they allowed the state to get computerized. But then 2 decades were lost by Kerala in the process of computerization. So the only way the global south and emerging markets will rise if they are able to use new technology to rise and grow. If you miss out the wave of AI, if you miss out the wave of quantum computing, if you miss out the new sustainable technologies of today, whether it's renewable, whether it's battery, whether it's storage, you'll miss out this race forever. Let me also say that every time this fear has been raised, there's been new jobs emerging. The world has a major shortage of data scientists. The world has a major shortage of machine learners. The world has a major shortage of product designers. There's a huge shortage. We need to restructure our school curriculum, our college curriculum, every single curriculum to design our children for the world of tomorrow. You'll have more and more of jobs. New jobs are inevitable. So first of all, I'm a great optimist on emerging markets, global south, developed world, all rising up to this awakening of the new technology which will transform lives, and new jobs will come. This, I have no doubts about that. That's number one. And to the second point about the pretty lady from here raised about technological billionaires and the immense power that they exercise, and I would say she's very right, because if you look at the western part of the world, all the entire technological revolution in the western part of the world has been driven by Amazon,
by Google, by Meta, by Apple, four companies which drove this. What we did in India, what happens when you get onto these companies is that they use your data and then they use it very powerfully for machine learning. They use it to make you, you order one shirt, they'll drive you more and more of shirts and cushions or whatever you've ordered. They're using the power of artificial intelligence. Your data doesn't belong to you, it belongs to Meta. It belongs to Google, it belongs to Amazon. What we did in India was just the reverse. We created a digital public infrastructure layer with 1.4 billion data. Every citizen has a digital identity. Then between 2015 and 2017, we opened up 550 million bank accounts. Every second bank account opened in the world was opened in India. And then we linked it up with both the digital identity and the mobile number. That enabled India to do fast payment, stock market, everything by the citizens. But the data is owned by the citizens through the digital empowerment protection architecture. The model can't memorize your data. So the data belongs to the citizen, not to the service provider. And that is why we democratize the technology. The data belongs to the citizen. That is why we are saying, read this book carefully. We're saying that the climate, is this is a huge, AI provides you this opportunity to build up climate public infrastructure of tomorrow, to be able to provide data for all disasters, all hurricanes, all natural disasters that will happen. You will have this opportunity to read the storm months before. In every municipality, every citizen, it is possible for you to get this access to data if we are able to democratize data. That's critical. Exactly. And the third point to this trade war hindering Global South, I think it's important to understand, all of you in LSE, that if you look at the global GDP for the last five decades, there's only one country in the world, which has been able to retain its share of global GDP at about 26-27%, with about close to 50% of the market cap. 50% of the market cap, 27% of global GDP, and that's the United States of America. They've been able to do it because it's a highly innovative society. They do disruption at university level. Massive amount of risk capital is available. That kind of risk capital is not available anywhere else in the world. The risk capital which has flown into Anthropic, which has flown into Claude, which has flown into vast number of young companies, that risk capital is not available anywhere else in the world. So you have a massive amount of innovation taking place. That's why United States retains that GDP. Understand? And that's cutting edge technology. On the second, the other is, look at China. I mean, it's moved from 4% of the GDP to close to about 17% of the global GDP. 4% to 17% of the global GDP by becoming a champion of cutting-edge clean technologies. China made itself a champion of electric vehicle, made itself a champion of battery storage, made itself a champion of critical minerals, all cutting-edge technologies. And they did it with intense and ruthless internal competition. Intense and ruthless competition. If a country becomes number one in China, it'll be a world leader of tomorrow. Because for every single company that survives in China, 99 companies die. Understand this. But they do this, ruthless internal competition. Now, if you have to match China and its manufacturing, and if you have to match United States and its innovation, you will have to get the size and scale of China right, or use technology to leapfrog beyond what they are doing. Get into newer technologies which will disrupt existing technologies for China. Otherwise, it will be impossible. That's the challenge for the rest of the world to be able to do it. The second is that for
to be able to beat United States, you'll either have to do far more greater level of innovation at your university level or get massive amount of risk capital, which may not be possible. And therefore, these are the challenges. Now, it's important for every single country, every single company, to build up its startup movement, which you're doing in India, to build up its Make in India, like we are doing, and to get into newer forms of technology. If you miss bypass the AI revolution, if you're not able to build up your own sovereign AI, if you're not able to use AI, because intelligence will get commoditized for tomorrow. The company and country which will make, which will win the battle for tomorrow, will be one which will commoditize intelligence. Get that right. Which will make intelligence available anywhere in a ubiquitous manner. And this is a challenge for the world. And therefore, it's important that we push our companies towards actually using powerful models which are being built to build applications on top of them and do your own disruption, like India is trying to do with Sarvam, etc., to make it multilingual and making it accessible at low cost by providing computing power and opening up its database for young startups. One question to the gentleman here who raised a very important point. I couldn't hear very well. I'm
a bottleneck.
Yeah, so I'd like Siddharth to respond to some of them.
No, I think, let me just answer your question first. And part of that question that I would like to answer, which is also linked to another question that was asked here, which was about how do we democratize this technology? And you, one of your questions was, what are the bottlenecks, in something like this today? I feel, apart from the things that Mr. Kant has, of course, covered in depth, one of the major challenges is on the data free flow between countries. And when I say data, often people get very, sort of terrified because they think, oh, we are talking about personal data. I mean, I've been to panels where the moment I say climate data, the moderators will be like, oh, well, let's not go there because we are talking about personal data. I'm sorry, the air quality in a region or the emissions of a vehicle do not count as personal data. Now, when you look at climate change, it is very much like air pollution. Air pollution is considered, the solution to air pollution will always be an airshed approach. It'll be an airshed approach because pollution does not stop at borders. Climate change does not stop at borders. Therefore, data needs to flow between different jurisdictions, between different companies, between different countries. Now, I also understand that there are concerns about this data. Some of this data is critical, some of this data is non-critical. But because of that classification, we often don't even touch upon this issue. We say, oh, we cannot talk about data. So I think it is very important to divide data into two different categories. Data that is security critical, which means that deals with, let's say, defense data, which is personal in nature, and survival critical data. And I think survival critical data is essentially data that can help you in coming up with better solutions to climate and energy. What I mean by that is tomorrow, I sit in India without understanding what the river flow patterns are across China, Bangladesh, Pakistan, who we share borders with, where we share common rivers, how can I end up predicting a flood with just Indian data? It is not possible, number one. So we need all multilateral negotiations to focus on data free flow with trust, but also divide this data into two very distinct categories and talk about making survival critical data as something that needs to be start getting shared between countries. The second thing is one of my senior colleagues from a big tech company has just joined. I belonged to the same big tech company. So I will just talk about that for a second. You know, when you talk about democratizing data, it's important to understand that it is a two-way process between people and between companies who hold vast amounts of that data. You will not believe what any big tech company, be it a Meta or be it, Google or be it any other company, would do to get good data from the government. And I'm again not talking about personal data at all. I'm talking about data literally about where public toilets on highways may be located, where solar panels are located, what the speed limits are, what the socioeconomic composition of a particular neighborhood is. And they would love to have this data because it allows them to make their products better. But what they also sit on is massive, massive treasure troves of data which they generally, you know, would not share. For instance, data about traffic, data about emissions, which they have, but, you know, it's also their sort of proprietary data. So one of the things that we also talk about in this book is rather interesting is that you sort of make this mutual, you make this a win-win situation for both. So if a country or if a big tech company actually wants this data from the government, then the government must also ask it to give back data. And this data should be called data commons. Again, not personal data, data about traffic, data about emissions, data about wildfire, data about 10,000 other things which affect the state of the play of our countries of the world. And therefore, the answer to that is data commons. And just to conclude, something that Mr. Kant touched upon here was wonderful, because he spoke about India's digital public infrastructure. So many of you are from India, but many of you are not from India. So to give you a very simple example, imagine taking a train from London to Oxford in a different era or in a different world, where every train operator, be it Chiltern Railways or, you know, GWR, were there to run their trains, they would also have to build their own railway tracks. Now, what happens is that only the big players who have deep pockets with a lot of money can operate trains, because they also have to build their own tracks. Because only a very few players will enter that segment, they can charge any amount of money. They can, you know, set a price which would be very high, and you still would have to pay. And you as a user will be, unfortunately, be forced to shell out a lot of that money. Believe it or not, this is actually the exact problem with the payment ecosystems in the world today. Your data is either owned by Visa or by MasterCard or by Amex or by Razorpay. What India did in this sort of Oxford-London example is that it created a railway track and said everybody who wants to operate their train needs to run on this track. And so therefore they compete with each other to get more ridership. They bring their fares down. You have more choice. And that is what India did. It created a digital railway track and it said every bank, no matter which bank app you use, what your account is, whether it's saving, whether it's current, who you are, you will be able to transfer money to each other because you're all built on a common rail. And the same thing needs to be done for climate and energy going forward, not just in countries, but globally. Thank you.
That was, if I could come here, that was one of my questions. The idea of the climate digital public infrastructure is critical. And could you, suppose somebody came along, Secretary General of the UN, and said, Amitabh Siddharth, I'd like you to describe to me how we're going to build this. What are the steps you take? Now, of course, in India, you had Aadhaar as a sort of foundation that enabled you to move forward, and it was visionary to create that. But what would be the steps that you would take or you would recommend to take in building this climate digital public infrastructure? Because it's core of the whole story, and it's a wonderful idea. But building it, how would you do it?
I'll take it. So I think, Lord Stern, some of the things that I mentioned are essentially steps which are involved in that. But should somebody, were to ask me what are the steps that are required to build DPI for climate, I think one of the first things for that is that you need to start building national-level data repositories. You need to build national data repositories where different data is actually democratized and made available. Again, just to say non-personal data. India has come up with this very interesting initiative that I came across the other day, which is called India Urban Data Exchange, IUDX. What they've done is that if you're in a city and if you're a smart city, here's a platform where all of the data, including the signals of the traffic signal, the timings of a traffic signal, the solar energy that's being generated, from various solar panels, the timings of the street light, the energy consumption of, public street lights, all of that is available on a single platform. Of course, now these platforms need to be expanded, but the idea is that the first step will involve, and even before this step, like I said earlier, is differentiating what is critical data and what is not critical data and what is personal data. First is you define that. Once you've defined that, the second would be to build these digital repositories, which could be national. The third step would be to incentivize people, companies, to start sharing data onto this particular platform. And those incentives could be very much, as I mentioned, that if it were a big tech company, you say, well, you have data on traffic. If you give that to me, you will get access to this data. Similarly for people, or similarly for, let's say, now again, let's briefly think about air quality. air purifiers in people's houses have sensors which can, you know, test the air quality. That's how you get your AQI reading. In some parts of the world, those air purifiers have been able to detect way ahead in advance when a wildfire had started. But that data was only available with the manufacturer of that product. So just as an example, if your air purifiers were to feed this information onto a public portal, that will make a lot of a difference. Google's phones, I mean, I don't have a Google phone. I used to have one when I was at Google. Now I don't have it. Now I have an iPhone. When I had a Google phone, it has these accelerometers. Those accelerometers actually, you know, when you sort of rotate your phone, your screen rotates. That's because of those sensors inside of your phone. Google figured out that the same sensors, if can also, very with a high level of sensitivity, can also start detecting earthquakes. And if many Google phones in close proximity to each other, they're triggered, then Google sends out what is called an earthquake alert. So the point is, it needs to be three steps. Define what that data is going to be. Figure out the incentives for getting people and companies to bring that data. And the third is to then encourage their uptake to build those solutions. Mr. Kant.
You know, the problem is, I mean, Siddharth has given away too much of the book out. Yeah, you shouldn't have spoken about this at all. But you asked a very provocative question. We'd prefer that you buy the book and, you know, and figure out how climate public infrastructure is built. But, you know, important point I want to make is that actually, Nick, 1% of the companies in the world today account for 46% of the CO2 emission. 1% of the company. Now, they're able to get away with it. These are all fossil fuel companies. They're able to get away with it because the market doesn't punish them. You know, you put out their data. You know, all this data is possible to get it out in machine-readable formats. You can use the power of AI to analyze their data and put it out in public domain. I've been a long-term believer that the data, putting it out in public domain and actually allowing the market to punish you is important. Imagine if tomorrow you're much like the stock exchange, if you're able to create this stock exchange to say that this company emits so much of CO2 emission, the top 10 CO2 companies, and what the extent of CO2 emission they are doing in machine-readable format, analyzed, and you need, like the NASDAQ, another climate ASDAQ, to really put this data out, and you'll see the stocks of these 10 companies plummeting down. So you need the market to punish these companies. And therefore, what Siddharth is really saying is that data is key. Our ability to use the power of AI to cut across geographies, analyze data, and put it in public domain is really the key. And therefore, my request is that you should propagate the buying of this book to be able to understand the power of climate public infrastructure.
I'm more than happy to encourage the buying of the book. And in a few minutes, you'll be able to do exactly that and get signatures of the authors. Now, we're fairly close to the end of time. I just wanted to check whether Emma and Ruth had anything to add, and then I'll say a few words. Yeah.
Just a tiny thing, if I may, and it's inspired by a couple of the comments that Siddharth just said. And just thinking of your example of wildfires, I was giving evidence to our Environment Select Committee on wildfires earlier this week, and we still, whilst we're in a heat wave, we still do not have a public alert system in the UK. We should be up there at the very high level, highest of levels right now. And so there is again your example of how this technology can help us, could allow countries like the UK to leapfrog forward. And then I'm thinking of a brilliant colleague of Nick and mine here at the LSE, Professor Nicola Ranger, who on Monday I had the privilege of launching a new platform called Resilience Arc that a lot of Nicola's work with her team now here based at LSE has been involved with. And again, this is about getting greater public open data about individual companies' performances and preparedness for the different storms that we are experiencing from a physical risk perspective? And again, how is it that a university like the LSE can best work with some of the brilliant thinking in your book to make more of this become a reality? This is where it gets really exciting, what the potential is for opening up this data so that more people can assess how prepared we are for the changes that we know are coming. So thank you.
Thank you, Emma. Anything you'd like to say, Ruth? Let me just make one or two comments, then I'll ask Siddharth and Amitabh, and then we'll close, because we do have to have a hard stop at 8 o'clock, and you need time to sign these books. Now, I wanted to recognise the way in which you've built your case and how valuable that is. You need to read the book to appreciate this properly. I have to say that, Amitabh. But you have to start with a narrative. People have to understand what you're trying to do and why. And they have to understand the intense danger. They have to understand the urgency. But they also have to understand the opportunity. And telling that story in a way that people can grasp easily is enormously important, and thank you so much for doing that. Many of us have struggled to tell the story, and you've managed to find a way for your story, which I think really does come across. The second is you have to have a strategy. What is it that you're going to try to do to deliver on this? And there again, I think you've given us the basics of that. We were just discussing the crucial climate digital infrastructure. They're getting these new data centres into the community so that they're not simply, as it were, an isolated creature of the big data company, but they're actually living in a community where they're helping with the heating and the cooling and the water management and so on. And some of the policies that we have to put into place will have to require that. They won't necessarily do that. Some might do it by themselves, but that's the kind of thing where public policy is enormously important, where, if you like, standards and regulation as part of the armory of public policy play a role. You're going to need institutional structures, and clearly the climate digital infrastructure is part of that institutional structure, and you have to build those. But you have to build them quickly, right, because we're in a hurry. And also, and this is where the last thing I'll say, you have to have international understanding. You don't need everybody, and if you insist on everybody, you probably will fail. But you need enough. You need enough to make the investments, to get things done, to support the international financial institutions in delivering the flows from richer countries to poorer countries that are going to be necessary. I don't delude myself that there's going to be a sudden outbreak of international aid. But what you do need is international institutions, and Jayant Sinha here is an expert on all this. International institutions, national institutions, private sector, private financial institutions in managing, sharing, and the risk that is associated with this kind of transformation. And so that kind of international responsibility is one that we have to speak up for and show why it's so important. And you did just that, Amitabh, when you were looking after the G20 with in such an expert way. You didn't need to get necessarily everybody, but you got, by putting the arguments very strongly in that particular context, you did actually get all the signatures that you needed. So that is diplomacy, it's argumentation, it's bringing national and international interests into alignment. And that's a big part of what we have to do. And I think everything I've just described here, to pick up on Emma's question, is what the LSE can do and should do. These are all social science challenges where you need careful thought, careful concept, careful treatment of concepts, but also in the context of a highly purposive, relentless pursuit of what we have to do to change, to do that in real time, to do that with the urgency that it deserves. So I wanted to close my bit. I will close the meeting in just a moment. But let me allow and welcome Siddharth and Amitabh if they've got last one-minute message for us.
Thank you so much, Lord Stern. I would just like to say that this moment is very special for me because I graduated from the London School of Economics 2016 to 2018. I did my master's in public administration here. And this hall has a lot of very special memories because I organized at least 7 or 8 conferences in this hall, the last of which was in 2018, actually. I was the president of the LSE South Asia Development Society. My friend here, Maitreya Thakur, he and I had started it together. He now works at the FCDO. So a lot of memories. And all I would like to say is that LSE has the potential to actually push ideas into taking off. So I really wanted to thank the London School of Economics. And now the LSE has a Global School of Sustainability. Lord Stern is the chair of that. Professor Jayan Sinha is now a professor in practice there. So I think there's a lot of action. LSE also has a data science institute, which very soon will become the Global Institute for Technology. So I think we will be seeing a lot of that AI climate interplay at the LSE. And before closing, just wanted to recognize that being here with Mr. Kant is even more special because he's been a mentor to me, and he's not just believed in building nations, he's believed in building people. Thank you to Ranjita ma'am, who's Mr. Kant's wife, who's accompanied him in all of these book tours. And also a welcome to Roshali, who's the global head of climate operations for Google, and my former colleague, Roshali. Thank you for making time. Thank you again, and I look forward to giving back to my alma mater. I'll be a visiting fellow at the Global School of Sustainability and to the Data Science Institute. So really look forward to giving back.
Thank you. Thank you, Siddharth.
I just wanted to say, Nick, that we are living in an extraordinary era when intelligence will be made affordable, it'll be made ubiquitous, and it'll be widely available. And there's no better opportunity for making it a better world of tomorrow, a more sustainable world of tomorrow, using this power of this technology. And there's no better institution than London School of Economics to drive this under your leadership. There cannot be a better leader than Nick Stern, and there cannot be a better institution than the London School of Economics to drive sustainability in the new world of tomorrow, which will be driven by artificial intelligence. Thank you.
Thank you. That's enormously kind, Amitabh. You're constantly welcome here, and the more time you spend here, the better for us and the better for the subject and questions that you have set. Siddharth, we're very proud of our alum, and welcome back, and we want to see as much of you as we can too, because this is a huge task, and India is absolutely at center stage in all this. A lot of people have organized, got into work to organize this event. Shantanu is here somewhere. Is Shantanu?
I think he's still enjoying the drinks at the Marshall Building.
Oh, well, in that case, I'll curtail my thanks to... I will note my thanks to Shantanu and all those who've helped make this happen at GSOS and so on. I'm enormously grateful. Thank you all very much for coming. I've enjoyed it enormously. The test of an academic's good day is if he's learned something. I learned a lot this evening. I learned a lot from the book itself. And if you buy the book and get it signed, you will learn a lot from the book. Thank you all for coming. Amitabh, Siddharth, Emma, Ruth, and thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.